36 degrees Kenosha, 54 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It is always a pleasure to reconnect with a first-rate author, and in this case, a best-selling author many times over, Tom Clavin, with whom I've had the pleasure of speaking on a number of occasions about several of his fine, fine books. One of the first opportunities we had to speak was to talk about his book he co-authored, Last Men Out. I think most recently we talked about his book, Tombstone. And there are a number of other fascinating books that Tom Clavin has written, springing out of his immense love of history, as well as his ability to tell a terrific story. His long resume includes all kinds of experience as a writer for television and radio, a reporter for the New York Times. He has won a number of awards, and his most recent book is fascinating indeed. And like several other books that he has written, it takes us to, in a sense, the Old West, or the Southern Old West in this case. The book is titled Follow Me to Hell, McNally's Texas Rangers and the Rise of Frontier Justice. In this book, Tom Clavin does an amazing job of bringing alive for us this period in North American history in which a large swath of the continent was consumed by what might be regarded as rampant lawlessness. And one of the forces of stability, if you will, that sprang up in the wake of all of the violence and mayhem was the Texas Rangers. And this book focuses in particular on a chapter from the Texas Rangers history, although it does give us a very vivid sense of historical context and really helps us kind of understand that whole notion of frontier justice and what it means when a small band of well-armed militia take matters into their own hands, if you will. And in the particular, of course, this story is quite complex and fascinating because it involves animosity running in several different directions. It's a story very, very well told in this book published by St. Martin's Press. Again, Follow Me to Hell, McNally's Texas Rangers and the Rise of Frontier Justice. Tom Clavin, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks for having me back. It's good to be here.
I'm really, really excited to talk with you about your fascinating book. Tell our listeners why 2023 is an especially appropriate year for this particular story to be told.
2023 is the bicentennial of the Texas Rangers, and when you think about it, it's pretty amazing that there's been a law enforcement agency that has existed in the United States for 200 years. The FBI has been around for about 100 years, so you really have double the amount of time the Texas Rangers have been in existence. So I'm sure there are books out there this year that will be a compendium of Texas Rangers history and talk about some of the legendary figures in Texas Rangers history, which my book does to some extent. But I also wanted to tell a story that was really a very focused story on a particular Ranger captain, legendary captain, and his adventures and the adventures that his men followed him to. So there's that. And just, I guess, as an aside, you mentioned in your introduction my book Tombstone, which came out in April 2020. And this new book, Follow Me to Hell, has a kind of a personal resonance for me because it's the first time since Tombstone that I've been able to revisit the American West. It wasn't so much that I was avoiding it. It's that other projects, you know, came, you know, sort of got front and center. You mentioned Last Man Out, which I co-wrote with Bob Drury, and Bob and I have remained as co-authors, and we did books called Blood and Treasure, and most recently The Last Hill, and I did a book called Lightning Down, which is a World War II story. So Follow Me to Hell represents my opportunity to return to the American West. And working on it, I realized how much I missed it. And how could I leave it for 3 years? But just the way things worked out.
I think it would be interesting to talk for a moment about something that you mentioned very early on, I think in your author's note or whatever it is with which you begin the book. But kind of talking about the exceptional challenges that are involved in sort of parsing out fact from fiction when it comes to kind of legendary stories, legendary figures like Leander McNally. And, I mean, we can really easily understand how someone who loves history would enjoy delving into this whole chapter of our history. But wow, what a challenge to sort of sort out the, what you call at one point, tales both tall and small that have sprung up around so much of this. Tell us a little more about kind of the dimensions of that challenge and how you have gone about kind of wrestling with that challenge in your previous books like Tombstone and in this most recent book, Follow Me to Hell.
I think that where that really hit me over the head was when I was working on my book, Dodge City, which came out in 2017, because my main characters there, actually three main characters, were Wyatt Earp, Bat Masterson, and Doc Holliday. So they have three iconic legendary figures. And as I was doing the research for that, I realized with some fear how much was written about these fellas that just simply isn't true or is greatly exaggerated or embellished. And so that made the challenge even greater, that you had to sort of separate the fact from fiction, find things that were actually factual, corroborated. I think I compared it to, at the time, it's like prospecting for gold. You're sifting through all the sand, and hopefully when you finished, in the bottom of your pan is a few, you know, nuggets of gold. And I found that was true when working on Follow Me to Hell, because Leander McNally is his legendary Ranger figure. And some of the stuff written about him at the time of his heyday, which was in the 1870s, was not true or embellished. There's even, I mentioned in the book, there was a time when it was reported that he and his entire company of Texas Rangers had been wiped out in a war with a battle with Mexican troops. And it took a while to have the media of the day, which was, you know, the newspapers and the telegraph lines, to sort out that's simply not true. Those are false reports. But meanwhile, headlines had gone around the country. So, and in the subsequent years, there's been, you know, sometimes people write history that they write it from the point of view of, well, here's my agenda, and I'm going to try and fit the facts to my agenda, or so-called facts to my agenda. Not that doesn't happen today. Of course, we're seeing it every day that people have agendas first and facts second, whatever side of the political spectrum you're on. But this is certainly true of the Texas Rangers, that over the years people have written about their history because, A, they want to talk about what great heroes they are, sometimes tend to exaggerate their achievements, or their agenda is the Texas Rangers were kind of lawless and vigilantes and shoot from the hip kind of figures, and so they want to, you know, find facts or invent facts that are going to fit that agenda. So that was a challenge in Follow Me to Hell, just as it had been for Tombstone and Dodge City and a couple of the other books. That what was it about Leander McNally that made him special, but really special, factually special? What kind of man was he? Why was it that the men of his command would literally follow him to hell and back? He claimed he could get him back again if he did. And it's a challenge, but it's also fun because one of the great joys I've had with working on these books about the American West and iconic figures is when you discover that the facts are just as exciting, if not more exciting, than the legends. And it's so much more fun to print factual information that's also page-turner than to print exaggerations or legends. Just copy what somebody else has done before. They didn't do it carefully enough.
We're speaking with Tom Clavin, talking about his most recent book, Follow Me to Hell, McNally's Texas Rangers on the Rise of Frontier Justice. That name in the subtitle refers to Leander McNally, who was a Confederate war hero who ultimately led the Texas Rangers for a very crucial time during their history in the 1870s, not for a long time, but for crucial years that saw the group really transform in a number of important ways. Mr. Clavin, one of the things I really appreciated about your book is that it really helped fill in the blanks for me as someone who actually fancies himself as knowing a fair amount about American history. I realized after reading your book, I knew so very little, or really didn't even realize how little I knew about the United States and Mexico and Texas and that tangled history, which is so crucial to understanding the story of the Texas Rangers. We don't have a lot of time for it, but you take a fair amount of time in your book to kind of paint the landscape for us. I mean, really setting in context the events that unfold. In a nutshell, I'm afraid, summarize for our listeners this complicated history and why it was that within this scenario sprang up this kind of culture of lawlessness that necessitated the ultimate creation of the Texas Rangers.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, there might be some people that assume that some of the issues that we have with Mexico today, you know, especially border crossings, is something that's of some recent invention, and it's really not. And that's one of the things that I discovered as I was researching and writing my book, Follow Me to Hell, is that the Texas Rangers really began as an agency to deal with issues on the border. Now, as many people know, even if you're not a geography buff, you know, Texas and Mexico have a very long border, you know, the Rio Grande River, and obviously other southern states do too, you know, California, Arizona, New Mexico, but they don't compare to the length of the border with Mexico and Texas. And going back into the 1820s and 1830s, there was a lot of problems with horse and cattle stealing on both sides of the border. And there was not only the official, so-called official war, the Mexican-American War in the 1840s, but there were always kind of conflicts and flare-ups and battles. And in fact, like climactic moment or chapter, several chapters in my book has to do when Leander McNally led his company of Texas Rangers on an invasion of Mexico. It almost resulted in a war between the two countries. I mean, President Ulysses S. Grant had to order McNally back to the United States because it could have become an international incident. So when I was writing about the border conflicts and what they call border ruffians and horse stealing and cattle stealing, and the exchange of gunfire and both sides of the border, the attacks and the retreats, and et cetera, I kept thinking, gee, you know, we're seeing almost on a daily basis in the news issues related to Texas and its border problems and the immigration problems that yes, it's a national concern for the entire country, but Texas in particular has that long border, and it's still rather porous. And this has been going on for, you know, as long as it's been the Texas Rangers. And again, they're celebrating their bicentennial this year.
One of the intriguing ideas about this whole period of our history is of Mexico actually cooperating with, permitting, and even encouraging so-called Anglo immigration into this region that we now call Texas. I mean, we know from hindsight how all of this is going to end up with the United States ultimately taking hold of Texas. And because we know that, it's hard to imagine that Mexico would welcome all of these Anglos sweeping into their territory. And yet this is something that they wanted to happen. Explain why that was the case.
Well, a big reason for it is that, I mean, they had mixed feelings about the Anglos, so to speak, who are coming in from Louisiana and Mississippi, a lot of the southern states. They had mixed feelings. They weren't that keen on it because, let's just face it, they were some big people from another country who were coming onto their territory, sometimes asking permission per person, sometimes not. But they came to realize, and Mexico was undergoing its own issues. I mean, it had its own independence issues when it broke away from Spain in 1821. The Mexican citizens who were living in Spanish Texas, there was very little to protect them against, the Indian tribes, who understandably were not keen on Mexican residents interfering with their hunting grounds and basically seizing territory that they had always, the generation had lived on. So a big reason why the Mexican government, aside from being somewhat realistic and thinking, can we really stop some of this emigration of white farmers and ranches? We can't really stop them completely. So maybe we'll let them in, we encourage them, we'll give them parcels of land to farm and to ranch, and they can maybe handle they could become the targets of the Indian raids instead of Mexican citizens. So that it was kind of a cynical reason, but that was the biggest reason probably why the Mexican government allowed Anglo immigration, allowed Anglo settlement and farming and ranching. And it worked well for a while, although eventually what happened is as more of the Anglos came in and were starting to outnumber the Mexican citizens in Texas, Texas got this idea that, well, maybe we should have our own republic and not be part of Mexico anymore.
Absolutely. And, of course, we now know how all of that played out. So explain exactly what was going on in the summer of 1823 when this colorful figure known as Stephen Austin actually sat down on paper kind of this proclamation creating what came to be known as the Texas Rangers. And at that point, was there already something in the air that sort of already sort of was that? And what did this represent when he created this document?
Well, when the Anglos were first settling in Texas in 1821 and 22, whenever there was some kind of emergency, some outbreak of lawlessness, or there was a raid by one of the Indian tribes, the Carrancouas, for example, it was sort of like somebody would say, hey, I need help, and you get 10 guys or you get 12 guys or even 20 guys who would grab their guns and their horses and would join together and go off on whatever the mission was. Somebody's been kidnapped or some farmer's been raided. We need to, you know, go get some revenge for that. And but what happened in 1823, you know, specifically August 1823, is Stephen Austin, who was the head of the colony, he was the one his father, actually Moses, had first proposed it and gotten permission from the Mexican government. He sent out this message that I need men to act as rangers to protect our frontier, to protect our borders. And so he sent out this proclamation, and the response was that people would not officially call themselves Texas Rangers yet, but they became a little more organized. They started to set up companies and did actually kind of training and did other things they needed to do to become not a permanent, they became something like a frontier special force. And that frontier special force did actual training. They did come up with supplies. They came up with ideas of how to protect themselves, came up with signals. They came up with other ways that they were going to be the special force. So that's how the Texas Rangers were born. Kind of like, I guess what you would say is militia. They were sort of like the Texas equivalent of the Minutemen up in Boston and Massachusetts that led to the Lexington and Concord. Of course, as we know, and you mentioned previously, the Texas had their own Lexington and Concord, several minor skirmishes and conflicts that eventually led to the breaking point with Mexico, which was the Alamo.
Hmm. I wanted to ask you about the choice of words, and I'm trying to remember now if it's Stephen Austin's choice of words or if it's your choice of words, but I know more than once we read about this group being formed as a sort of militia. And just kind of curious about that qualifier. I mean, in what ways was this not just simply a militia? I mean, was there something about this that made it not quite a militia in the purest sense of that word?
Well, I think with a militia, you can also conjure up the idea of certain uniforms and certain insignia and a little more of an organized group. And that was not the Texas Rangers. They stayed very ad hoc and very informal. So they were militia and that there was a call to arms, but they would just basically just show up with whatever they were wearing. They had different guns. There was no rules and regulations. Just everybody gathered together and let's go, you know, do our job.
I think that helps us understand kind of the nature of this group, and in a sense, I suppose it also helps us understand their limitations, but also their potential. I mean, that is, there are certain advantages that that come with what you just described.
Well, the advantages were that they were very skilled marksmen, for example, and they were used to living on the frontier. They were the frontier. And so, you know, everybody had certain skills they brought to when they had to gather together, to work together, to, let's say, for example, there had been a kidnapping and they were chasing people. They had horses already, and they had good horses. They had guns. They had good guns. They were good marksmen. They knew how to live off the land. They knew how to do camping and riding fast and enduring all kinds of weather, whether it was the middle of winter or the middle of summer. So these were what you could call rough and ready rangers. They were rough-hewn men that were used to difficult environment and surroundings, but they were ready. You know, at a moment's notice, if the call came out, they could pick up their gun, get on their horse, and go to where they had needed to go.
By the way, you tell us that this term ranger had actually been around for a long, long time. Actually, if I remember correctly, it had been used for centuries in Europe. Can you help us understand the term a little bit better? I mean, why would people like this be called rangers?
Well, you know, one of the things I point out in the book is that there was a group called Roberts Rangers that were in the French and Indian War that fought on the side of the Americans or the British Americans against the French in the French and Indian War, and that sort of set a precedent because they were a little more organized. They were definitely more organized than the Texas Rangers were in the beginning. But we had those Rangers. Ironically, that same group fought against the Americans in the Revolutionary War and in the War of 1812 to some extent. But the idea of ranger, the word ranger conjures up the idea of somebody who roams far and wide, who can be in one place one day and be in another place the other day. And that's sort of like what the tradition of a ranger is, somebody that can move fast, move quickly. One of the things that comes up in the book, Follow Me to Hell, about McNally and his rangers, is they had to sometimes ride very hard. They had to be someplace fast. You know, they would get a message that something was about to happen, like some big cattle rustling operation was going to happen at 4 o'clock the next morning. Well, they had to be someplace else really quickly, and there was no trains at that time to get them someplace. You had to get on your horse and go. So the word ranger does conjure up the idea of somebody that there was virtually no limits to where they might have to go to do what they needed to do.
Hmm. One thing that we get from your account of the Texas Rangers is that kind of by its very nature, they would attract kind of an intriguing array of men to be part of their exploits. And sometimes people who had a genuine sense of a desire for justice, a desire for law and order, but in some cases, by their very nature, they would also attract a different kind of man with very, very different interests and motivations. And I suspect that had to be one of the most interesting things for you to write about in in your new book, Follow Me to Hell.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because one of the fun aspects of working on this book was packing it with a lot of colorful characters, and I didn't have to look far. You know, there are people like Bigfoot Wallace, who is one of the significant characters in the book. There's John Coffey Hayes, one of the probably the earliest great Texas Ranger captain. There's Rip Ford, who was one of the captains in the 1950s. There's characters who joined the Rangers not because they were big believers in law and order, because they wanted the adventure, or they had some kind of personal agenda. There's a character in the book that was referred to as Old Jesus, who became part of Benelli's Rangers not because he had this great sense of justice, he cared about frontier justice, but he was seeking revenge against. He believed there had been Mexican bandits who had harmed his family, so he has a chance to get revenge. There's generals, there's Sam Houston, of course. There's Indian characters. There's people that invaded Mexico during the war. They were in the army. Sam Walker was an important character. For him was the Walker Colt. Samuel Colt, the inventor of the character in the book, because it was his gun that at first he couldn't even give this gun away. He invented the 5 and 6 shooter. Couldn't even give it away, and yet when Texas bought 1,000 of those guns, it completely transformed the frontier for Texas, because suddenly their firepower increased by 5 or 6 times, and they popularized the Colt gun that became the Colt 45, for example. So I found when I was working on this book that almost every page there was a character who was saying, okay, my turn, my turn, my turn. Some people might find this not very interesting. I find it fascinating that there are quite a few footnotes in the book, not academic footnotes, not citations where I say, oh, this is from something in 1956, page 12. But some characters needed a little more information about them, just, you know, what they eventually do or what was their background. So I'd hope people will read the book not just because it's got a lot of adventure in it and a lot of history, but because almost every page you're going to be introduced to a character you want to know more about.
We're speaking with Tom Clavin, and we're talking about his most recent book, which is called Follow Me to Hell, McNelly's Texas Rangers and the Rise of Frontier Justice. And we're about to get to the matter specified in the subtitle, namely one Leander McNelly, called by Tom Clavin one of the most revered figures in Texas Rangers history. And you call him a transitional figure as well. I mean, really somebody who helped take the Texas Rangers from kind of their old ways of doing things to the new ways of doing things. So this is a figure of a very, very great significance, even though his time with the Texas Rangers was actually quite limited. Before we get to who he was specifically, take us from where we were to where we are now in the early to mid 1870s. And what is the situation in Texas, which ultimately necessitates some of the, let's call them, reforms that will come about under Leander McNelly?
Well, Texas is recovering from really two things. One, the Civil War itself, it was very prominent, one of the more prominent states in Southern secession. And then there was the years afterwards, the Reconstruction period, where many Texans were angry at the federal government because it felt that it had become like an occupied state. Not the only one, certainly. Most of the Southern states who had been part of the Confederacy were subjected to Union troops maintaining law and order, and also enforcing the new rights that African Americans had in the United States after the Civil War. So by the 1870s, they were basically finally back to where there were few, if any, federal troops, maybe cavalry forts, of course, but they needed to get back on their own feet as a government, and also financially. And the financial part was important, because this transition that we're talking about is that the Texas Rangers, from the time that they began in 1823 through the Civil War and in the aftermath of the Civil War, had always been they got together when there was an emergency or some kind of urgent situation. And when that was taken care of, they sort of disbanded again. And even if they were called back together 3 months later or 6 months later, whatever it was, when their mission was over, they disbanded again and went back to their farms and their businesses. But what happened was in the 1870s is the Texas government realized they need a permanent frontier force. They eventually called it a frontier battalion. And so they reformed the Texas Rangers and finally came up with a budget that would keep them together indefinitely to this day, as it turns out, you know, to 2023. And Leander Gnelli was the first great post-Civil War captain of the Texas Rangers. He was right in the middle of that transition where he was with the Texas Rangers because he intended to be a Texas Ranger for as long as life would let him. And unfortunately, as people who read the book will find out, even though he was a fearless, totally courageous, and seemingly inexhaustible man, he was a very ill man because he had tuberculosis. And in those days, it was completely incurable, and you just tried to extend your life as long as possible. McNally extended his life by being on a horse and going on adventures. So that was the big part of the transition, was becoming financially solvent, and you could have a Texas Ranger force on call all the time. And also the imposition of law and order, which was very important. The pre-Civil War Rangers, sort of law and order was, sort of like beauty is in the eye of the beholder, law and order in the eye of the beholder, or whatever that particular Ranger captain. The Texas Rangers began to have a system of what was law and order, what was justice, what were the rules of the road, so to speak, we had to follow, and everybody had to follow them. You had to mete out law and order indiscriminately to everybody. And so that made for quite the transition. And McNally finally, after all his adventures, had to pass the baton. And from that point on, there really was more of a professional aspect to the Texas Rangers, which we really see to this day.
Hmm. Do I remember correctly that there were, at this point, kind of two divisions or branches of the Texas Rangers created, and that McNally was charged with leading one of those?
Yeah, there was specifically, McNally's Rangers were the Washington County Volunteers, even though they were paid, they were called volunteers. And that they acted as, there was like the rest of the Texas Rangers, and then there was McNally's Rangers. They acted as sort of like a SWAT team. You know, they were sent by the governor wherever there was some kind of outbreak of violence. For example, one of the important parts in the book is in DeWitt County, the feud between the Sutton family and the Taylor family, which made the Hatfields and McCoys look like something out of Sesame Street. I mean, one family would attack the other, and then the other family would get its revenge and back and forth. This is where the outlaw John Wesley Hardin comes in, who fought on the side of the Taylor family. So that had to be that feud, deadly feud, had to be dealt with, and that's when McNally's Rangers was sent in. And when there was this especially rampant cattle rustling and horse stealing going on the border in what's called the Nueces Strip, that's when McNally's Rangers were called in. And then you had a man named John King Fisher, who basically saw himself as the law unto himself, a big ranch owner that thought, well, he doesn't have to pay attention to the rules of the rest of Texas. He's his own state, basically. They said McNally and his Rangers went up against John King Fisher to sort of corral him and get him back on the side of law and order. So that's what made them kind of different. They basically were sent anywhere in the state where there was the most urgent need, and that made them, in a sense, kind of like a Texas Ranger SWAT team or SEAL team.
You know, as you were describing all of this, it occurs to me that one of the advantages of having more of an ongoing force is not just that you don't have to then keep regathering that force every time the need arises. I mean, it isn't just a matter of convenience, but it's also, in a sense, a matter of excellence. And the fact that when you have this fighting force that is always in place, you also, in a sense, have their experience, a collective experience that gets built up over time, and a sense of the context, the landscape in which they are functioning. And I should think that probably made a very significant difference in terms of their level of effectiveness.
That's a very good point because, yes, when you have these basically these units reforming every time there's a call to arms and then mustering out when the mission is over, you don't have quite the same discipline, for example. And one of the things that McNally's Rangers did that sort of was part of this transition is that because they were together all the time, wherever their missions took them, there was always some certain amount of training going on. There was a certain amount of discipline. There was a chain of command. You know, McNally was the captain, and a man named Robinson was the lieutenant, and he had a Sergeant's Hall and Armstrong. So you had a command structure. You used the word experience. Well, they spent shared experiences, which was good because whenever their new mission came along, they could draw upon each other's experiences and collective memory about, you know, what happened before, what they did before, what worked before, what was effective. And certainly a certain amount of camaraderie. They became brothers in arms out in the field. Whatever the dangers they were in, they were sharing them together. So that's a very good point about what that transition of the Texas Rangers, what it sort of brought to the new Texas Rangers, so to speak, as opposed to the old one, which were, again, basically, let's get together for this particular mission, and then when it's over, we go back and we pick up the plow, we go back behind the counter of our general store. And then it could be months, if not even a year or two, before they're called back again to work with each other.
Well, let's talk about this charismatic figure of Leander McNally, who ultimately takes charge of the Texas Rangers at this point in time, or at least that's kind of Special Forces Division, and goes on to lead them in some really extraordinary exploits. One of the things you tell us very early on in the book is that Leander McNally, just to look at him, would not have looked like any sort of heroic figure whatsoever. In fact, I think
he was definitely not Paul Bunyan-esque. Put it that way.
Right. In fact, you quote one of his men, you say, who was an admirer of his, describing McNally as sick and puny, a little runt of a feller. So tell us what his secret was. I mean, if he was not kind of imposing in the most sort of natural and obvious sense of the word, what was it that allowed him to be such an effective leader in this kind of situation?
Well, certainly one of the main principles of being an effective leader is you don't ask anybody to do what you wouldn't do yourself. And so the fellows who followed McNally saw that he was, you know, he would be camping with them, he'd be riding with them, he'd be doing training with them. And what made his extra impression is they knew that he had, you know, this potentially and ultimately fatal respiratory disease. And so it was even harder for him to do the things that they did. The things he would be, no matter how exhausted he was, he would not give in. He would always, you know, go that extra mile that he needed to. And they admired this stubbornness and this desire to get the job done, get the mission done. He also had a fearlessness, which they saw in the numerous battles that they fought with him. Now you could point out that he certainly knew that he would not have a normal lifespan, that you know, that fearlessness came from he'd be much happier taking a bullet in battle than dying in bed from consumption. But still, that was very inspiring to them, that the people who followed him. He also pointed out to them, which he showed by example. He said, "I will always lead you from the front." There are other examples in the book, Follow Me to Hell, of leaders who followed from the rear, and they didn't get the respect from their men that McNally got, because if they were going into battle, McNally would not be caught shouting out instructions from the back of the room, so to speak. He'd be on the first horse in front. In fact, there's a couple of times when he outraces. He's in such a hurry to get somewhere that he outraces the men who were supposed to be right behind him, and gets there first and is suddenly all alone. So that was something that they really admired, that he was going to do everything that he was asking them to do, and he would do it fearlessly.
By the way, we just have to take a moment to talk about his most famous moment in the Civil War. Incredible feat which he helps to engineer in which hundreds of Union soldiers end up surrendering to him and his small band of troops. Can you just touch on this really interesting incident? It certainly speaks to his intelligence and creativity as a leader.
Well, one of McNally's talents was to do the most with the least. And he found he had this talent early on when he was when the Civil War broke out. He joined the Confederate Army. I think he was still only about 19 years old or 18 years old. And within a couple of years, he was the captain of a company of scouts. And in one particular event, there was there had been a battle going on, and the leader of the Confederate Army said to McNally, "We need you to secure this bridge." A number of bridges, and this one particular bridge was guarded by about 400. Just on the other side of the bridge were about 400 Union troops, and McNally had 40 men at most under his command. So he decided that night he would have his men run back and forth and ride back and forth across the bridge. Yet he and his officers were shouting orders to each other. They were making all kinds of noise and shouting, and you could hear guns loading. This went on all night. And as the night went on, the Union soldiers were getting more and more nervous because, as far as they were concerned, the entire Confederate Army was forming on the other side of that bridge for the attack in the morning. And sure enough, when the morning came, McNally rode out there with a couple of his officers, and he met with the Union officer in charge, and he said to him, "We're just the advance guard. You know, the Army's right behind us. We will attack, and you guys have no chance." And the Union officer said, "You're right. We surrender." So he surrendered his 400 troops to McNally's 40 troops, and they took them all prisoner. They were probably pretty red-faced afterwards, but that was just one example of McNally was a particularly intelligent guy, which, again, was a reason why the men who followed him admired him, because he didn't blunder into things. In fact, he caused other people to blunder into things.
Hmm. So in the, I think it's 3 years or so that he is head of this division of the Texas Rangers, he ends up leading them on one expedition after another. And it seems like most notably, he is taking the Texas Rangers on more than one occasion into Mexican territory, which of course was something that could have easily provoked war, or led to catastrophe and so on, and it seems like this is a really good example of his daring. Can you tell us more about some of the most notable examples of this?
Well, there's one in particular that is really like a climactic, if not the climactic moment of the book, is that McNally is so frustrated by the repeated rustling that's going on that at one particular point where these cattle thieves and rustlers are escaping into Mexico, he takes his men. Now, he does say to them, he basically says, and he's got, I think he's got 26 men with him at this point. He does say to them, "We're going to go at the great risk here. I don't know what's going to happen. If anybody doesn't want to come with me across the Rio Grande into Mexico, step forward or step over there, no problem." And everybody to a man said, "No, we're with you, Captain." And so he basically invaded, and this is November in 1875. He led an invasion of Mexico by the Texas Rangers. You won't necessarily find this in any textbooks, but he was risking a war. And he went into Mexico. He attacked a ranch there. His object was he wasn't leaving Mexico until he had those stolen cattle back, and the thieves who had taken them were going to be brought to justice on the Texas side of the border. And he encountered the Mexican army. The Mexican army sort of, they retreated back to the Rio Grande River, but they dug in on the Mexican side. He refused to leave. There were orders coming from the immediate, U.S. Army commanders to get out of there. Even telegrams coming from Washington, D.C., the Secretary of War said, "You've got to get out of there." And McNally said, "No, I'm not. I'm here on a mission, and I'm not leaving Mexico. I don't care if a war starts. I'm not leaving until our mission is accomplished." So in a way, McNally's Rangers became the U.S. Army, in a sense, and as far as Washington was concerned, on the wrong side of the river. I don't want to give away what happened because some people might say, "Well, then I'll have to read the book." But
right, exactly.
But at one point in the story, McNally's Rangers, all 26 of them, are being approached by a Mexican army that has swelled to 1,500 members. And so things are looking pretty tough. But even then, McNally says, I'm not leaving. I'm not leaving until I complete my objective. So if people want to find out what happened, they're going to have to read the book.
Exactly. So as you studied him and his exploits with the Texas Rangers, what sort of ultimate impression did you come away from in terms of who he was and what he stood for? I mean, and is he someone wearing a so-called white hat as a good guy or a black hat as a bad guy, or is he more of an intriguing mix of the two?
Well, yeah, I think with the latter. And to be honest, I think he's wearing a gray hat, some kind of mixture of the two, because he very much cared about justice. In the subtitle is Frontier Justice, and he really cared about justice and fair play and doing the right thing. But he also was the product of a time where, you know, the right thing was not treat Indians as equals, for example. You know, the Indian tribes were in the way of what was seen as American progress and expansion. He didn't disrespect Mexicans, but he had to go to war against them. I mean, he more than once, you know, crossed the border into Mexico to mete out what he believed was justice. But he also he had a lot of personal integrity. He believed that the best way for Texas to be was to be without these conflicts. But until that happened, he had to go out there and with his men enforce the law. The laws were not as enlightened as they are today. I mean, you're going to find as much as Leander McNally is revered as a Texas Ranger captain, you're going to find a Texas Ranger organization that is much more evolved, much more sophisticated. It's sort of like the Texas version of the FBI today, which was not the case back then in McNally's day, where everything was still done on horseback and with six shooters and rifles. So I think it's particularly interesting to read the book to see about that particular captain, Leander McNally, his place in Texas, his place in Texas history, and compare that to what's going on today, where you still have frontier justice and border issues in Texas, but the stakes have gotten a lot higher.
Hmm. And you mentioned that the Texas Rangers are still with us, at least to some extent.
Very much so. I mean, if you go on, you go to the Division of or Department of Public Safety website in Texas, for example, the Texas Rangers have a lot of responsibilities. I mean, they're still sort of like a SWAT team. They're in a special investigative unit. They're still in charge of border regulation and border law enforcement. They greatly expanded from the way they were in the 1870s, but all the roots of what they are today you see in the 1870s and the Leander McNally.
The book is fascinating, and once again it's titled Follow Me to Hell, McNally's Texas Rangers and the Rise of Frontier Justice, published by St. Martin's Press. The author's Tom Clavin. Tom Clavin, you've done it again. Thank you so much for giving the world this truly fascinating book, and thank you for being my morning show guest today. It was great to reconnect with you.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for giving the book the attention that I hope it deserves. Readers will let me know.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I am excited to reconnect with a former faculty colleague of mine from Carthage College, Dr. William Kuhn, who for a time was a professor of history at Carthage, but he has gone on to a very successful career as a published author. And tomorrow, we're actually going to be talking about a book of his which was published 10 years ago and is still going strong. William Kuhn's first novel called Mrs. Queen Takes the Train, which imagines in remarkably authentic fashion a scenario in which Queen Elizabeth II, around her 80th birthday, wanders off the palace grounds and ends up enjoying something of an adventure in the so-called outer world. It's a wonderful novel. It just received its 1,000th customer review on Amazon. And that was the reason I reached out to William Kuhn to see if he would be interested in talking about this novel. I'm so glad he agreed. We recorded the interview late last week, and we will be sharing it tomorrow on the morning show. A reminder that there will be no morning show broadcast this Friday or Monday because of the holiday, but you can still hear the morning show if you subscribe to the morning show podcast. Look for the morning